Okay, so we will begin. The one of the problems I've always felt is both a problem and a disadvantage and an advantage with maps is that as soon as you put something on a map, everybody believes it as actual, factual, correct proof. So this means that maps are subject to abuse and can be used for propaganda. So what I want to do today is to look at, stay with this theme of delusions, deceptions, and so on, and take it a little bit further, one step further, and look at maps as propaganda. This often involves maps used during wartime, and we'll visit that periodically as we go through the material. So I talk about this in Geography 12, and I begin, or actually I end, with Marc Monmonier's, what he calls his 11 rules for polishing the cartographic image. And I illustrate some of these in the lecture. I think these are kind of tongue-in-cheek. I don't necessarily need to write them down. But he's managed to hit on many of the aspects here that are studied a little bit more formally in the theory of propaganda. So we'll look at propaganda. So notice that some of those distraction, generalization, enchant with elegance, gloss over, be selective. These are going to come through as we look at some of the theory around propaganda. So the source is Monmonier's book. I just passed it around, but I always think this has been going on forever. We've looked at the example of the Zeno brothers in Friesland already. It's an excellent example of maps being used for promotion and propaganda. Why? The Zeno brothers wanted to sell books, and they did. They sold them very well. So just looking very briefly at some of the techniques of propaganda, propagandacritic.com is a good source of information here. We're going to look at each of these different themes, one after the other. So these are the three types that they often talk about of propaganda: word games, or playing with language. And we're going to look specifically at toponymy in the next section of the class, starting next week. We're going to look at how name calling, singling out groups of people, or singling out regions is often done. As we'll see when we look at toponymy, you can simply wipe place names off of a map. We'll see that done in two different contexts today and next week. Glittering generalities means that you provide something that's so general that it sort of dismisses any problems. For example, this is from Victory Through Air Power, a Disney movie made in 1942, which was made largely to try and negate the very influential anti-war and anti-intervention attitude in the United States. It wasn't until Pearl Harbor that the U.S. actually did enter the war after Britain had been fighting alone for almost 2 years. So, for example, here's a good glittering generality. Here's the map of the big line sweeping through North Africa and surrounding the Mediterranean. Of course, Switzerland has recognized Spanish neutrality, but it hasn't recognized Swiss neutrality in the way that that's been colored. So these are the kinds of generalities that you can get away with. And use of euphemisms and never quite saying exactly what you want. That's another form of propaganda. False connections, this idea of transfer. If I can twist my enemy's words and put my words into his mouth, then I'm damaging him. So this is the idea of transfer. And testimonial, the lending support to somebody that you favor, a country that you favor, is another way of making a false connection. And then special appeals. We'll look at all three of these, actually. Plain folks, and you'll hear this. I mean, I watched part of the Republican debate last night. And you hear the plain folks to a politician is always, I've nothing to do with Washington. I'm not a Washington insider. I've been a two-term senator and a congressman, and I want to be elected into office in Washington, but I don't want to be a Washington insider. So this is playing plain folks. I'm like you, not like them. The bandwagon effect is a way for people to behave by saying, get on the bandwagon, and everybody's doing it as well. And then fear, which has been predominant in the last couple of years. So let's look at some pure cartographic examples and take it from there. Now let me start with one from the Cold War, and we'll return to the Cold War later on, and that's what the Russians call Maskirovka. Maskirovka is a set of procedures designed to confuse, mislead, and camouflage oneself from the enemy. In terms of not a cartographic context, you may or may not have heard of the massive deception exercise that was undertaken to cover the Normandy landings in World War II, the D-Day landings, where an entire aerial assault, artificial aerial assault, was taken place on a completely different area, to the extent where they dropped rubber dummies with parachutes on over enemy territory to make them believe that they were under parachute assault. And in fact, it actually worked. And British airfields had inflatable tanks and aircraft all over the place to try and confuse the enemy from their aerial photography. Maskirovka is a very simple example of that from a cartographic context, and it involves deliberate place name changes on maps. So this was predominant under the Soviet Union during the peak years of the Cold War. They not only changed place names or eliminated places from the maps, they changed the types of features. So, you know, railroads became highways, and highways became jeep trails, and so on. And they often inverted hierarchies, so a major train line was depicted as a little tiny remote individual track. They put artificial places on the map to try and distract and confuse. The Russian space city, for example, didn't even exist on the maps. It was labeled as a village. And often they put grids and coordinates on the map, or they simply relabeled them so that the places didn't make any sense. If you thought they were latitude and longitude, they were not. Somebody had mixed up all the numbers. So Monmanier described this in the book. He said, one form of deception useful at all levels of war is disinformation directed at mapping and navigating skills, and Soviet cartographic disinformation affected all publicly available maps of urban areas. There's a famous paper, that one of the few that was actually openly published by the CIA, about the history of the map of Moscow. The map of Moscow that was produced by the Soviets was impossible to navigate with because it had entire streets left off, misnamed, buildings not even marked, such as the KGB building on Dzerzhinsky Square. I love this stuff. So as a consequence, the US embassy had to supply its own map of Moscow for its own staff. And the CIA, the cartographic division at the CIA was brought in to produce this map, and they produced it from aerial photography, from spy satellite images and so on, and they really did a pretty good job of it, to such an extent where it became in demand in Moscow to actually get the US embassy map, because it was the only one that actually showed you how to get around the streets and not get lost. Got to visit the CIA, and I told them some of these stories, and I said, could you give me a tangible example of where they've deliberately altered a Soviet map to disguise features? So the example they gave me is not very good, but I'll go with it anyway. Here's one of the standard 1 to 250,000 sheets from the CIA's world coverage. You see that it looks much like the regular charts. This is part of Siberia. And you can see some roads and some mountains and a large river. This is the Russian equivalent of that same area. It's mapped to the Corsa scale, so the Russians didn't map at any scale more detailed than about 1 to 250,000, just to disguise the generality. And I've sat and studied this map for quite a long time, trying to figure out how it relates to this map, and I can't. I can't find a single place name or feature that really maps well between those two maps. This is the example. That's the source of the Russian map. I don't ask me to pronounce that. I haven't a clue how it works. It's sheet T10930, and it's a scale of 1 to 400,000. This is 1982. It's very, it's not long before it's all going to fall apart. The level of detail that's going on here has to include all of this. So here we see approximate alignment. It's a railroad, but nobody's ever been there to verify it. They've only seen it from spy satellites and imagery, so they put it on there. There's a settlement here, but nobody knows what its name is, so it's just labeled settlement. Lots of this kind of lack of distinction. Of course, now we can just go to Google and take a look, and we'll notice that the town that was completely missing from this map is actually quite a significant settlement. It's this one, Kug and Huby in Tajikistan. So it's just simply been removed from the map. Who knows why? No reason. Okay, so let's pick up on some of these propaganda themes and take them a little bit further. We'll start with the bandwagon effect. So what the bandwagon says, something great's going on, get on board with it and join it. And again, we'll use a Soviet example. Just as the United States has enormous historical and immigration-based ethnic diversity, so also does the Soviet Union. Did the Soviet Union, much of it's broken up into individual countries now. But the need for the Russians to have unity among all their different ethnic groups, many of whom couldn't speak Russian, same thing goes for China. So here we're being told that all people are equal under communism. So all ethnic groups now have equal status. So this is the bandwagon effect. Joseph Stalin is the big father watching over everybody. This is out of Mamanir's book. Cartographic propaganda can be an effective intellectual weapon against an unresponsive, biased or corrupt bureaucracy. And he gives an example in the book of this map that was put together by people who were opposed to the expansion of a Dutch airport because of the extra noise that it would lead to. So they started monitoring and getting together all the information about where planes were and how much noise they were generating. Put up a website that allowed you to go in and just see how noisy things were. I assume most of you live around IV. I've noticed over the last few months that all of a sudden aircraft are being scheduled for takeoff well before 6 a.m. Now, 6 a.m. was always meant to be the break point when you couldn't have any aircraft takeoffs before 6 a.m. So United now has two scheduled flights that leave before 6 a.m. Now one loads up, taxis out there and sits at the end of the runway and waits for it to turn 6 a.m. and then takes off. That's sort of really pushing the law to the limit. So if one of the nice things about volunteer geographic information and public websites is that this kind of protest, using maps of propaganda can be effective. Let's look at fear, one of the standard methods of propaganda. And we find, this is from a British textbook in geography that's looking at, somebody working on the wall there. This is from a German textbook on how to produce propaganda maps. This is an illustration of it in another textbook written in English. But these are the kind of special purpose symbols that are often used for depicting things on maps. For example, this one is known as a land hook. It's a line with symbolic hooks at either end that joins two pieces of land together that are disjoint. It's used in cadastral maps to show that one owner has two pieces of land, or a parcel of land has two locations. But on a political map, it can very much literally be a land hook. Okay, cartoons often use maps as a way of depicting propaganda. This is a German cartoon from World War I, depicting Britain as being... having other motives for the Entente Cordiale. The Entente Cordiale was the agreement with France that they would unite and mutually support each other. So here, to detract the French, we simply say that, well, what is the Entente Cordiale? It's unequal. The British are in fact getting to eat up France like a huge spider. If you look at the legs, each one sits on a British colony. Gibraltar, Malta, Egypt, Turkey, a little link here, and so on. And here's the German eagle sitting there with his crown on, looking out over the whole thing, looking fearsome. Notice that his United States makes an appearance on this too, which is kind of interesting. So wartime propaganda maps are very common. This particular map had a very strong influence on France and its entry into the war. This is actually a fairly common phenomenon during wartime, that all of a sudden a map appears that's been stolen or captured from the enemy that shows it their long-term plans. Now, ironically, this was reasonably true at the time. So here's a map of Europe divided up as it sees, or as Austro-Hungary would take over and dominate all of Europe. So you see Austro-Hungary now extends from Trieste, we'll talk about Trieste in a minute, all the way to Moscow. We have Romania left off here. And then Greater Germany goes all the way from the Spanish border through France, all the way into Poland and Russia on this side. And you see that even Britain is labeled as a German colony, and Ireland as an Austro-Hungarian colony. So that when you get this, and then you the dream of Germany is the headline. It appears in the French newspaper. It says, here I've discovered the plans for Germany and Austro-Hungary to Austro-Hungarian Empire to split up all of Europe. Here's the same thing being done in World War II. It's a new war, same idea, where we have captured German plans for their expansionism in Europe. Grab, that's the Nazi policy. So here we have Germany in 1937, and the dates which each invasion is going to take place are listed here. So France actually was invaded in 1941. Britain, fortunately, didn't make that. That was going to be 1948, and so on. They were even going to take Portugal. So much of this obviously never happened, but some of it did. So this is a little bit of name calling. If you want to depict your enemy as a threat, this is one of the ways you could do it. So this is the German press now trying to depict Czechoslovakia as a threat to Germany. So how do you do that? Well, you say that anything based in Prague, capital of Czechoslovakia, is now within 550 kilometers flying range of just about every point in Germany. You know, only these places are safe. So we depict it radially, separating outwards. So if you want to depict a threat, you do it by drawing circles of range distances. And we still do this. We still often depict threats with big circles. And notice, by the way, there's a website up now that allows you to put any size nuclear bomb anywhere in the world and then blow it up and draw the circles and see where they are, where the damage zones are. Kind of an interesting idea. Expansionism, more fear type maps. Here's Joseph Stalin himself, shown in black, Soviet Russia, expanding into Europe. Very much an idea of the post-World War II period, the rapid expansion, the creation of the Iron Curtain. So we've got countries in Soviet political, economic, and strategic bloc. That's what became Eastern Europe. Countries with communist or communist-influenced governments, that includes Yugoslavia, for example, and Czechoslovakia here, both of which eventually came under the Soviet Union. Countries under strong Soviet political pressure, that's everything else, right? And then we've got countries not yet decided, so obviously France and Sweden are the issues here, and Joseph Stalin's reaching out with communist symbols to place those flags into the countries. Here's an interesting sort of piece of politics. This is an article from Life in 1953. This is an era when the Iron Curtain has now descended across Europe, as Churchill called it, from the northern limits all the way down to Trieste in current-day Italy. This now is represented by a barbed wire fence, which it quite literally was. So barbed wire pretty much the whole way, and a great deal more besides in many places, including machine gun turrets and so on. So this is taking a little different role. Antwerp is depicting itself here, or the article is depicting Antwerp as the heart left in East Germany, and that it's quite literally bringing in produce from all over the world, sending it out still to East, to German ports like Rostock, and that information is finding its way in, and here we have people coming into contact and spreading information, and that information is getting back. Now, it's depicting Zurich as a center of communications as well. So the idea that there's something more than troop fronts and fighting, that we can also have this this sort of more of an intrigue war that took place during that period. Again, fear-mongering, this is Japanese propaganda. This is a map published around 1941, before World War II, before Japan was already in World War II, was already fighting in China and other places. But now the Japanese government depicted the United States as a threat to the Japanese Empire. As you're probably well aware, they had intended to declare war just literally minutes before the first attack waves hit Pearl Harbor. In fact, they garbled the translation of the declaration of war, so it never arrived. It was an unprecedented, unprovoked attack. But this was the sort of propaganda that was creating that. So here we see Japan with its brave fighting soldiers completely surrounded by a U.S. embargo, a blockade, stopping Japanese vessels bringing produce to the island of Japan. So if you want to depict yourself as standing alone against an enemy, you're an island without connections to anything else. So the Philippines was seen as a major threat. In fact, they eventually took the Philippines from the United States at this time. As an air target, there's something that proved massively correct in the long run as the war wound down. So here we depict, this is Japan and Korea. And now we're looking at travel distances from the Chinese mainland, from the Philippines, from Russia, showing that Japan is indeed susceptible to attack from the air. And it was exactly that method that was eventually used, going island by island, slowly increasing the air range that was the policy until they dropped the two nuclear bombs. Here's another comic depiction, but there's a lot of symbolism embedded in this one. So it is a map. Hark, hark, the dogs do bark is the title. So we're depicting stereotypes, putting labels here on groups. Each one is being represented by a dog. Okay, so Britain's being represented by the bulldog here. And here's Winston Churchill standing in Scotland with all of his ships on strings, threatening Europe. And here's the dachshund of Germany and the poodle of France and so on. I guess they ran out of ideas for countries like Spain. They had to use a matador here. But here's the Russian steamroller ready to crush everything once war gets underway. In fact, it was a steamroller, but it was pretty much stopped dead. The Cold War was a unique period for propaganda. I'd say it was a period of fear propaganda coming to its height. Anything since has been relatively mundane by comparison. But the Cold War changed the scope and the range of cartography. You might say it was the World War II Pacific War that really opened up the world's geography to the public. Nobody had really thought about things like attacks happening on a different day because you're on the other side of the time zones, the other side of the date line, and so on. So the Pacific really exposed a lot of people for the first time to the massive size. World War II exposed people to the massive size of the Pacific and the world itself. But the Cold War kind of brought it all back together again, because it was very quickly realized, most people's popular view is that here's the United States, and then there's a couple oceans in the way, and then there's Europe, and then you reach Russia to worry about. But all of a sudden, Russia now, as the Soviet Union, goes all the way from Sakhalin and the Aleutian chain all the way into Eastern Europe. And you realize very quickly that that pretty much surrounds the North Pole, and that the distances across the poles are very minor, very short. Now, this means that a rocket launched, say, from Archangel up here, north of Norway and Finland, can hit a target in the United States in less than 20 minutes. And we take that for granted now, but you know, that was an immense threat at the time. So in the United States, the response was to strengthen support in Europe, and that remains its policy. We still have a large number of soldiers in Germany, for example. But then also to set up an early warning system for incoming, originally, aircraft. And you see they're marked here as three different lines. I want to take these up now. The first one's called the Dew Line, the Mid-Canada Line, and the Pine Tree Line were set up as early warning systems to detect originally incoming aircraft and later incoming missiles coming over the pole. So I always say that the cartography, certainly the projections, had to change radically when the threats are now over the pole rather than traditionally from Europe. So the air defenses over Canada during the Cold War led to just an extraordinary advances within cartography. You might say that this program was sort of the granddaddy of most of the things that we take for granted today. The project was called the SAGE. I'll unencode that acronym in just a minute. It consisted of warning lines across the continent, three of them, Pine Tree Line, the Mid-Canada Line, and the Dew Line, that were chains of radar stations. And these were extended then out into the ocean by putting radar stations on stilts out in the water. And these were used to partition the U.S. up into air defense regions, each one of which had to be autonomous. They had to have their own control, like their fighter aircraft and the ability to respond, even missile systems for response, that were localized within each of these areas. So this put enormous pressure on the technology at the time, because remember, no internet, computers are antiques. They look like that's a computer at that period. These are some of the original consoles that are in museums now. This console in particular, the SAGE console, was extremely important in the development of computer cartography. Here's somebody working at it. You notice he's holding a gun, a laser gun, that he can use to read the light intensity off the screen at any given time. This is simply an oscilloscope. This is a radar scope. He can put it down and read the intensity of the light signal at any given time. This is sort of the very first light pen. It was the mouse or the sensor that you might think of today. The SAGE system was enormous. It stood for the semi-automatic ground environment. Oh, let me just make one more connection here. The development for SAGE was done at the MIT Lincoln Labs. IBM worked on the computers. It became operational in 1959, and it was part of NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense, until 1989. This is really pretty recent. And interestingly enough, there are personal connections. Jay Forrester, for example, who was one of the two pioneers on the project, later on founded a field of study called systems dynamics, which actually then went into urban modeling and produced computer simulation models of cities. So it was very, very geographic. So SAGE, by 1964, had cost between $8 and $12 billion. The exact cost never really has been released. At the time, it pushed the limits of computing. They had to build a computer for it. They built the ANFSQ7. This is before the invention of silicon chips. Okay, so they built it with vacuum tubes, 55,000 vacuum tubes, 2,000 square meters of floor space. You know, that's the size of a warehouse, and weighed 275 tons. And it required its own power station, basically, to run it. You turn all those vacuum tubes on, they're absorbing a lot of energy. Telecommunications for the system were radio and telephone-based. So this meant they had to invent the modem so that they could communicate over telephone lines. So what communications have to take place? We've got all these remote radar stations. Here's one of the ones in the ocean. Those are sending back enormous amounts of radar information that needs to be centralized. It's centralized in a series of control stations around the country, which have to be nuclear hardened, so they're built basically inside massive quantities of steel. Here's one of the control stations, so we get the whole idea of the control room. You know, all those James Bond movies where they go into the control room, these were real places. And sure enough, there is a digital map being projected up on the screen here. So what we're seeing is the oscilloscope, and we're being able to trace incoming aircraft. We then have to communicate outwards to the air defense systems. These are some of the missiles that were stationed around major cities in the United States. There was an active anti-missile station in Los Angeles that was designed to protect LA. By the end of the program, by the 1980s, they had directly connected the incoming detection information to the autopilots on the intercepting planes. So the pilots didn't even have to steer. They could just take their hands off and they'd be guided to the locations where the incoming aircraft were located. The intercontinental ballistic missile really made this kind of irrelevant. As we all know now, they can travel so fast and they can go outside of the atmosphere that this was largely aircraft defense. So I've often argued that SAGE has a direct link to computer cartography. The CRT display, that's that computer display, and the workstation were developed by RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, right down the road here. The system included input and output, so it had a way of depicting the screen here. And when the project first began, the world maps for the radar oscilloscopes were being drawn on Mylar by hand and then put over the radar scopes. And very quickly it was realized that you could have the oscilloscope draw the map. And one of the people who worked on doing that at RAND Corporation, in their very first job, was Waldo Tobler, who was then a graduate student in geography at the University of Washington, came down and worked a summer at Santa Monica on exactly that issue of getting the maps onto the computer screen. He then wrote this classic article, Automation and Cartography, that was the first article about computer cartography, the sort of granddaddy of all GIS, in 1959. So there's a direct link between the two. Okay, let's continue with this this theme of fear, although this is sort of name-calling as well. And this is the idea of gerrymandering, and you've probably heard about this in other classes. Gerrymandering means one way of winning political power is by dividing up or diluting the power of your opponents. Who gets to redistrict after the decennial census in the United States? Well, in most states, in fact, pretty much uniformly across the country, it's the political parties themselves. So the people who are in power get to choose the districts, or get to choose how the districts are changed. California, as of just a couple of years ago, by popular ballot, has decided that we'll appoint a citizens commission that will do the redistricting. And in fact, that redistricting for California after the 2010 census has now been completed, and the first districts have been defended in court. But before then, things were rampant. I mean, political districting had become a fine art. This is not new. It dates back to the Tammany Hall days in New York and in Boston. Here's the original article that gave the gerrymander its name. This is an article in the Boston Gazette in which they caricatured the way that they put together a political district that was basically all the suburbs, so that all the non-Labor supporting votes went into just a single district. So they win that district, but they lose overall because you're dividing the political power. All the inner areas were all supportive of the labor unions. And it continues to go on. This is probably the highlight of gerrymandering. Now we've got the computer to help us do it, so we can do it really efficiently. North Carolina's Congressional District 12 after the 1990 census, which actually was approved and went on and became a voting district. So we've got the cities of Charlotte, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, High Point, Durham. Basically, somebody has taken every single Democratic vote in the entire state and put it all into one district. And they've done it by arguing that interstate highways are a way of connecting districts together. So they actually ran the congressional district boundary along individual highways. Sometimes it's only a few hundred feet wide. Well, it goes on, and it goes on. Here's California District 23, which we're actually in right now. This is your votes, folks. This lowest caps currently represents District 23. It's been pointed out over and over again it includes the Channel Islands and all of their zero residents. Well, actually one. I think there's one guy who lives on the lighthouse here. And then it extends from Port Hueneme all the way up the coast beyond San Luis Obispo, right up to the county line, San Luis Obispo County, including all of the coastal areas. So again, this was a blatant attempt to take all of the districts in this part of the country that were likely to be Democratic and put them together. This is why it's called packing, this technique. You simply take the districts that represent the dominant demography and you put them all together so that their political power is divided. You get one representative, but that's all you're ever going to get. The opposite is what's called cracking. And here's a good example in Texas. We're seeing the whole process being repeated in Texas, because Texas, after the 2010 census, is actually going to get, I think it's five more congressional districts, which means that all these have to be reapportioned again. This is Tom DeLay's district, District 22. And what's being done here is that the population that, if you think of the demography around Houston, it's sort of distance decay effect as we go further and further away. So here we're taking a particular piece of the demography, splitting it away from the rest of the districts within Houston. This is called cracking. When you divide, you make a district which divides up people so that the overall effect of what would be a majority is now divided between multiple districts. So it's almost like taking pie slices out of a city center. Those are very common ways of doing that. Okay, we talked Mamanir, and in our propaganda rules, we talked about glittering generalities by glossing over something, another way of doing propaganda. And it's very easy to do with maps. Examples that I've given in class before is in choropleth mapping. As we all know, choropleth maps appear in almost any book, journal, website, magazine, television station. We can manipulate the classes, the way we classify them, the number of classes that we have, the colors associated with them, to say pretty much anything we want to say. Okay? Whether or not we do that depends on our motive. So here's three maps of exactly the same data about housing in Pennsylvania. And you can argue that everything's pretty uniform, or everything's extremely clustered, or it seems pretty randomly balanced, depending upon how we classify the map. So I always advocate that, you know, when you see a choropleth map in a newspaper, and the New York Times is now doing newspaper maps pretty much every weekend, LA Times is doing whole page maps on quite a regular basis, look very carefully at those choropleth classification methods and how many classes are being depicted, because you'll often see bias. Well, if you want, here's the ultimate glittering generality. The sun never sets on the British Empire. At its peak, there were parts of the British Empire so distributed over the world that quite literally the sun never set on the entire British Empire. So this is what I grew up with. All the red parts, Australia, India, South Africa, England itself, Canada, are all parts of the empire that distribute things around the world. Now the rest of it's mostly like little tiny islands on New Zealand here and get depicted. But I would argue the map is just simply a backdrop for this. This is really about the glory of empire. Britannia sitting here in her on a globe look. Here's all the great minds of the British Empire supporting it. And here's the troops in India and so on, the sailors on the ships being depicted all the way around here. Freedom, fraternity, federation. Sounds like the French liberté, égalité, fraternité. Here is what I would argue is one of the most glossing over maps that you could possibly imagine. This is John Mitchell's map of the United States in 1775. And obviously a very important, influential period. 1776 is about to happen. The United States, the states are about to become the United States. But they had a colonial history up to that point. Places like New Jersey and so on, Virginia, were in individual states. And there was a huge amount of belief that each colony on the coast actually simply owned everything, as far as you could go in the United States. This was sort of why it was believed that eventually the West would be opened up, because the land holdings would simply run all the way across the country in these bizarre strips. Now, obviously, after independence, and largely because of Thomas Jefferson and the likes of that, this never happened. They needed a survey system, a way of dividing up the states. Incidentally, this the story of this particular one comes out of this book, How the States Got Their Shape. This is one of the most fascinating books you could ever read. It's pretty much full of amazing stories. So let's look at just one of these stories about a particular state, and that's Connecticut. At this time, here's little Connecticut. It, at the time of the War of Independence, they had a dispute between New York and Connecticut about ownership of the land to the Hudson River and beyond. They'd been in dispute since 1683. Liberation now means that we need to resolve the dispute. And in fact, they ceded this land to New York. But in compensation for that, and Connecticut has suffered quite a bit of damage during the war itself, it was decided to actually recognize some of its claims to land further in the west. So they couldn't originally claim Pennsylvania. That was partitioned off and made another state by itself. So they skipped that. They eventually ceded the land beyond Illinois, what was going to become Illinois and Michigan, in 1786, but in fact this little strip of Michigan that ended up between Ohio and Michigan actually has its own survey system. It's separate because it was begun when it was kind of no man's land. A lot of people say that's the origin of the rivalry between Ohio and Michigan. But look at this curious little piece of Ohio here called the Connecticut Western Reserve. It's still called the Western Reserve. This turned out to be the area where they began the first experiments in land partitioning, where Jefferson himself got involved in land speculation and division. It remained part of Connecticut for a very long time. It was settled by Connecticut residents in 1796, and it wasn't ceded to the United States until 1800. Enormous amount of land was ceded to the United States well after the Revolution. So it, a really curious history. If you look at the survey tradition, the land holdings, the shapes of the states themselves, they were all highly influenced by that belief that states simply owned everything as far as the Pacific. So it's easy with maps to distort your belief. I chose this one because it's something reasonably topical. This is the Border Protection, Anti-Terrorism and Illegal Immigration Control Act of 2005. You know, we might say the peak of the period of controversy over all of these issues. So this is back when they set up webcams along the border and they started building a wall and so on. Don't get me going on it. But they began this campaign. It ended up in House Law 4437, which came up for vote, was approved by a majority in Congress, and then defeated in the Senate. So it never became law. But they still maintain their website. They update it daily. This is stopthenorthamericanunion.com. So look, they believe that the United States, Mexico, and Canada are getting way too friendly. I don't know why we possibly managed to do that, but some people do. So here's their map of the vote. They choose, of course, only the vote in Congress, not in the Senate, because that's the one they won. And then they depict it with the eyes being blue, and it that clearly covers most of the country. That's actually by a congressional district here. Okay, so what we're seeing is congressional districts. You can see our District 23 being depicted here. And they've clearly chosen these colors in this schema to show that they should have won, basically. Notice some of the largest states only get a single congressperson that would match the representation. We've got that single dot represented for Denver. Here's another glossing example. Here's Joseph Stalin, now he's in uniform. After the war, now they have to colonize Siberia. They believe that they have a vast resource that can feed the entire nation, because most of it's tundra, it's not particularly useful, but they forcibly are going to populate it and farm it, can develop their own agricultural systems for it, and it's still some of the best soil scientists in the world are Russians. But if we want to convince the public to support this, we put it in war terms. So we will defeat drought too, that's what this says. We're a victorious army. We've got marching troops of agricultural systems going across the country. The problem with drought, not enough water when you go out to these regions to farm, just as the same problem in the United States. Here's an alternative view of reality. Aboriginal Australia. Here somebody's used a website as a way of repartitioning land back to native groups and tribes among the Aboriginal residents of Australia. So it's kind of interesting, useful, because it shows you a challenging and a different view of the world. Maps can be used to promote, and this is also a form of propaganda. They're used extensively in advertising. In the early days of the automobile, maps played an important role in getting people to use their car for leisure as well as for business. Originally, they didn't do that. And they still promote driving for pleasure. So here's I forget the year on this, 1901 or something like that. No, it can't be. Must be much later than that. So we see that here's the progress of history. Look, Indian Trail with the pack horse, the settler with his wagon, the Wells Fargo wagon, and now the car. So this is progress of technology being depicted on the cover of a map. So what do you want to do when you open the map? Jump in your car and drive, right? And that means consuming gas. So it was the gas companies that were interested in promoting travel, so they quickly latched onto maps as a way of promoting it. And there are people who actually collect these old 20s, 30s, 40s vintage maps. Interestingly enough, when they started producing these maps, they noticed that around 1910, 1915, they noticed that people were getting lost because there were no signposts on any of the roads. So they could mark the roads on the maps, but there was no way to tell where you were or how to get around a particular village. So it was the companies that produced the maps and the gas companies that produced the first road signs, and in fact came up with the first road numbering schemas. And they had to be later taken over by the states and federally during the 1920s and 30s. Again, promoting settlement. These are both promotions for California. They use different schema to promote California. This is a gold rush map. Map of the gold regions of California. This says how to get there. Basically, you can go around South America or through the Panama Canal because you're coming from the cities of the east. And once you get there, here it is. There's the golden part of California where you can just go and pick up gold from the streets or from the dirt. So this was enormously popular. These were appearing in broadsheets and newspapers all over the East in 1848-49. Here's another way of promoting. California, cornucopia of the world, room for millions of immigrants. Wouldn't go down that well today, would it? 43 million acres of government land untaken. Railroad and private land for 1 million farmers. Does it say free of cyclones and buzzards?
Blizzards.
Yeah, my eyes are going. So it's promoting the climate even at that stage. So a climate for health and wealth. It's another way of promoting settlement. And the idea here is that the railroads had opened up the land, had opened up access, but there was nobody there. And the railroads depended upon trade and business and people traveling, and they needed to get customers, and in distributing people, they were able to. here we, this story gets more and more intriguing sort of by the minute. In a way, this is sort of microcosm of everything in one picture. Now, this is a project in Dubai where they have all these artificial islands that are being built off the coastline as land speculation to build mostly houses and mansions, but in some cases shopping centers and hotels. This one was started, it was called The World. So it's a world map built out of artificial islands. They built this barrier first, it's since been completed. And you could go in and buy your independent mansion in, you know, Antarctica or Africa or United States, and you know, put your luxury yacht there and keep it there year round. Now, interestingly, the financial crisis after 2008 sort of took the wind out of the sails of this this development. Many of these are unsold, and the project, in fact, is not even completely finished. It's only one of several. There are others that are in the shapes of palm trees and all sorts of things. It makes an interesting zoom in on Google Earth. I've talked about this map in Geography 12, but it's worth it. Very similar to the California story. Here we're promoting railroad traffic within Canada. So same thing, a few facts worthy of careful reading about Manitoba and the Great Canadian Northwest. So this is Canada trying to promote settlement of its own west by arguing that it's easy to get backwards and forwards. There's this huge network of railways that we can just travel upon. In fact, many of those were just planned. They didn't exist at the time, but eventually they did, and the west came into play. Once the railroads across Canada were built, again, they were worried about getting traffic on them. So in some traffic they can support. The way they created travel was to build a series of these massive hotels. This is the one in Quebec City, the Chateau Frontenac. And they repeated these at strategic intervals across the country, so each one about a day's train travel apart. So you could take a luxurious tour across the country, starting in Quebec, stay in this hotel, go to the next hotel, and so on, until you ended up on the Pacific coast. And we had exactly the same thing right here in Santa Barbara. Now, if you ever walked along the waterfront down there by the harbor, you may have noticed there's a clear piece of grass with two rows of palm trees going down the front. Well, those are the original entrance way to the Potter Hotel. Now, the Potter Hotel was built as a speculative tourist hotel in Santa Barbara and to promote Santa Barbara as a luxury resort outside of Los Angeles. It was quite extraordinary. Road of a Thousand Wonders, Santa Barbara. It in fact burned down mysteriously in the 1920s, probably for insurance fraud. But it influenced a lot of things. Las Bañas del Mar, for example, was pretty much right across the street from it. Well, why did the first public swimming pool in California exist right there on the waterfront in Santa Barbara? Well, it was being serviced by this hotel. So if you want to promote wine in California, you gerrymander, right? California is just one huge wine zone, right? But in fact, the only areas that we've actually depicted on this map are those that are known for producing wines. Of course, we produce wine all over the state, but that just gets a picture of some grapes in the background. So this is this has revealing some biases. Now, you might say the ultimate revelation of biases was triggered by this guy, Alfred Mackinder. He was a professor of geography at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom. That's just him. Who was an early and very influential person in the field of political geography. And his sort of life work, the papers that he published, all involved this kind of wacky idea. He said that world political geography was about land and possessing land, and that the most important part of land in the world was Central Asia. I don't know how he decided that, but that's what he did. And he argued that there was what he called the pivot area. Whoever owned that land controlled all the political power in the world. There was a crescent of zones beyond it, which traded with it. There was areas of deserts, and then the whole of the rest of the world becomes labeled the land of the outer or insular crescent, and notice that that's all of the Americas and Australia and all of South Africa get included in that. So this theme, the idea that if you controlled the heartland, you controlled the world, was pretty much laughed off in geography in Europe. For example, he's conveniently chosen a map projection that promotes this idea. Notice that that's not actually the way things are. He's drawn an ellipse around it, but it looks like a cylindrical projection behind it. So even his geometry is off. But the idea was taken up in Nazi Germany, where they converted Mackinder's idea into what they called the concept of Lebensraum, the idea that Germany didn't have enough land resources for itself, and that we had to take them from Central Europe. So the German designs were to seize all of Russia, all of European Russia, and were justified largely using Mackinder's ideas. These are the areas that were seized, and technique was pretty much uniform. It started with the Sudetenland here, the idea that German emigrants were under threat within their countries, and invasion had to happen to protect German citizens. Then they would go in and invade the country. Same thing happened for Austria. You ever seen Sound of Music? That's basically the plot of Sound of Music. Austria being seized and no longer being an independent country. It included later Czechoslovakia and Poland and so on. And eventually France, all up to about this line, and so on. So this idea of Lebensraum was used to justify this concept. Okay, name calling. What we name things very much affects them, and this one, ironically, is back in the news. How do you, if your political support in Argentina is beginning to flag, what do? You go back into your history and you raise some issue that's going to get people jingoistic again. It happened before, in the 1980s. The Argentinians invaded what they call the Islas Malvinas, which the rest of the world calls the Falkland Islands, which has been occupied by Britain since the mid-1800s, but in fact is actually self-governing and doesn't have that many populations. You notice the place names here are quite extensive. East and West Falkland, Port Howard, Port Stanley, or just Stanley, the capital here. If we want to... this is off of the Argentinian government website. If you want to depict them as the Islas Malvinas, you simply lose all the rest of the other settlements and you rename the capital, Puerto Argentino. So you're exerting a claim just by simply naming it. And ironically, you know, after a war which ended up killing some 2,000 or 3,000 people, to take it back again and involved the sinking of a battleship, they're doing it all over again, which is kind of bizarre. I mentioned Trieste before, because Trieste is kind of a very interesting place because it's part of a piece of land that sort of falls between Central Europe and Western Europe. And it has a very complex history in World War I, basically because the front line ran right through Trieste, actually here, Monfalcone, and up here, the place called Gorizia. So it was taken by the Germans, taken by the Italians, backwards and forwards. The same thing happened in World War II. The city of Gorizia was pretty much completely destroyed. At the end of World War II, when the Italians switched sides, Germany tried to hold this and eventually lost out to British and US invasions. But just as the war was ending, the Yugoslavian sort of patriots, the freedom fighters, pushed into this territory and ended up occupying half of it. They occupied this part here. This is Capodistria, a little town here, Pirano. These are beautiful old Roman towns. So after the war, this was seen as sufficiently politically sensitive that it should be divided and become an international territory. So it was divided up into Zone A, US and British administration, and Zone B, which would be under Yugoslavian administration. And that worked for a little while. There actually was a castle out here on the coast that was the headquarters of the U.S. Occupation here that lasted right up until the 1950s. And then eventually, when Yugoslavia became under Soviet influence, it simply stepped in and took this, annexed this zone, and this now becomes an international zone and then affiliates with Italy. But Italy has to exert authority over it, so when it's an international zone, 1920s, they send a single warship there to occupy Trieste. And it simply pulls up to the dock, and the soldiers get off, and now they're depicted as this glorious marching soldiers. In fact, they just were completely unopposed. They probably stopped and had some cappuccino afterwards, you know. But the history is that they want to depict it as land that was conquered and taken for Italy, whereas in fact it was really just part of a political decision. Now this goes on and on and on. This is a particularly interesting map that was produced for an article by Ralph Peters, who's a retired military general in the US Army, who was very outspoken during the Iraq War, the Second Iraq War, and came through with a series of articles criticizing what was happening in terms of invading Iraq and so on. In this one, 2006, Blood Borders, How a Better Middle East Would Look, he proposed a political division of not just Iraq, but all of the Middle East. Notice from our history before, here's the current situation, the way it's depicted. Here is what he proposed, a really quite extraordinary solution. Now, you notice that we've chopped up Iran, we've freed some of the districts of Iran, we've chopped up Iraq, we leave Kuwait intact, but we also chop up Saudi Arabia. This was highly controversial at the time. The idea that this could ever be advanced as a political solution was extremely controversial. Then we have sort of the ultimate in terms of territory and territorial acknowledgement. On this side we have, this is from the Indian government's website, and the one over there is from Pakistan. So this is from the CIA's website. Okay, so the CIA at least recognizes that here's India, here's Pakistan, here's China, and that there are two provinces, Jammu and Kashmir here, and what they call the northern areas, and then a series of zones that are under contentious claims. So they label them and put the claims in here. Okay. From the Indian point of view, here's Pakistan, the entire claim is part of India. And this is really taken for granted. If you go to India and study geography, this is what your atlas will depict as India. All of these districts, including some major cities which are actually in Pakistan, are considered part of India. And if we go over to Pakistan, you notice that they've done the opposite. They've pushed the limits of the region out so that there's almost no gap here. There's no Chinese border with India here. We go straight into Nepal. So here's Islamabad. So you notice that these are all now cities that are depicted as belonging to Pakistan. So India's fought four wars now over this region, and it remains contentious. It's highly unlikely to be resolved in our lifetimes. Here's another area where maps and politics meet. We all know, we at least talked about the problem down here in land claims, but this country, which in fact does not exist as a legal entity, Kurdistan, represents a group that is fighting for ethnic recognition. They have populations in Iraq, in Syria, in Turkey, and to some extent within Iran. And you probably remember that before the Second Iraq War, the Kurdish regions of Iraq were separate and maintained as so by US and British air control. Here, interestingly, we see that the terrorism problem that was recognized in Turkey right now, of Kurds, Kurds' political party is believed by the Turks to be a terrorist organization, and they actually have crossed borders to fight it. Notice that we're tied up here with the events going on right now in places like Homs, down here, in Syria. So the border is a Kurdish region again. But then who gets the rest of Turkey? Greece, of course, not Turkey. Turkey's been wiped off the map here. So there's a country missing from this depiction. Then we have places where the border becomes very finite and very tangible. Cyprus has always been an independent country, relatively independent, so the history goes back to a very, very long time. In 1973, the Turks decided that Cyprus should be Turkish, so they sent an invading force in, which was stopped dead in its tracks along this line. And that line just simply froze in place. It's a line that in some cases represents a sort of no man's land, in other places it's a hedge. In this street, it's simply a metal barrier and across is the road. So your neighbors who live in the same building as you are in another country, the equivalent. Now, the Turkish occupied part of Cyprus is recognized only by Turkey. The whole of the rest of the world believes that the Turks should get out and give control back to the Republic of Cyprus. But it hasn't happened. And this political situation is just frozen in place. There are many, many instances where this sort of thing has happened worldwide. Now, the lessons that we're told and the things we believe about the world are often not what they seem. We have a part of New Mexico where we have a nuclear test site, and what happened there for a long time was considered completely under wraps. The first land database that I got in the United States, I quickly zoomed into this region, and it was just a huge single polygon that covered most of northern New Mexico. It was labeled government land. When I was I spent a year working at the USGS, and there I met Alden Culver Carrasas, and he said that he didn't like the secrecy stuff. They were about to cover them, publish the map sheet, the 1 to 250,000 map sheet that would cover the Nevada test sites. And he said, we're just going to do it. I'm just going to publish it. So it's got geology on one side, and the other side has the 1 to 24,000 equivalent air photo. And so after that, nobody worried too much about these secret zones in the United States, although there are very many of them, some of them much closer than you might think. Now, of course, again, we can go in and Google Earth and look at anything that's there. There's the Trinity Blast, the one that gave the world nuclear power, or at least nuclear explosions. This book, there's two more books by Mamanio. This one in particular, this one's called Tales of Maps and Carto Controversies. So this covers some of the political issues I've been talking about. This one is called Run Lines and Map Wars, and it's called The Social History of the Mercator Projection. And about a half of this book is about this map. Arno Peters was a German historian who sort of independently discovered for himself that map projections sometimes distort area. he thought he was going to solve the problem by inventing a map projection. He called it the Peters projection. In fact, it's not a new projection, it's the Gaul projection that was invented over 200 years ago. But he then set out to try and sell this idea that the whole of the rest of the world saw a distorted world, and in particular one that overemphasized the northern hemisphere and Europe and North America and didn't give equal credit to Africa and parts of Asia. So why look around, here's the map, and then around it, why this new world map? This goes on and shows you all the wonderful things that this map does. In fact, totally unaware of the fact that all map projections are distorted. He made two important sales. He got the World Council of Churches to adopt this map. It's not the group that you'd normally think would endorse world maps, but apparently it did. And UNESCO, the United Nations Cultural Organization. So as a result, this became very widespread, and everybody suddenly started talking about this controversy. And there's the website, and I checked it this morning, it's still there. They're still advocating the use of this map as a solution to the world's problems of equality. At least now they recognize that the Earth is round. The challenge of any world map is to represent the round Earth on a flat surface. There are literally thousands of map projections. Yes, that's sort of an acknowledgement by them that that it is indeed an issue. But the controversy continues for no good reason. So here's my last slide. The thing about cartography and depicting things on maps is that ultimately he who creates the maps who creates the distortion. So it's the producer who has the responsibility for the ethics behind the map creation. These days, anybody can make a map. It's so easy. I mean, get on you know, open source software, or you can get onto Google Earth or whatever, and your map is ready and out there with audiences of millions within seconds. So this responsibility now passes to everybody. So first of all, we have this producer versus consumer responsibility. The responsibility is with the producer not to use maps for propaganda purposes. Editing and error catching, even the best cartographers make mistakes. As soon as your audience sees maps with mistakes on them, you will become aware of them. I've seen professional atlases with things like Hong Kong misplaced by hundreds of miles. Cartographic traps are just plain unethical. Cartographic trap is deliberately mislabeling something so that if somebody copies the map, you can claim that they violated your copyright. In the United States, facts about the surface of the Earth are not copyrightable. So the content of a map, if it's depicting facts about the Earth, is legally not subject to copyright. Often maps are made with the best available data. Well, best available data stands, if you take the acronym, that's BAD, or bad data. In other words, all data is bad, basically. It can always be improved, but you're under the obligation to not only find the best data to depict on the map, the truthful data, but also to verify it. And you'd be amazed by how few people verify the information they put on maps. All maps contain uncertainty, but they hold significant power. That's the point that I started with. As soon as something's on a map, people accept it as fact. And that's not going to change overnight. All map design decisions are partly subjective. There's always some creativity or an artistic talent involved in that final layout of the content. And keeping that under control and making sure that it's done responsibly is the producer's responsibility. And as I often say, this is a term I adopted when I was, again, from working with the USGS. A map is really simply a set of errors that have been agreed upon. In other words, all data are bad, everything is relatively uncertain, things are going to be lack of timeliness or out of date. We simply have to do the best that we can with the materials that we have available to us. So what I hope I've done today is at least alerted you to the fact that an enormous number of maps are actually produced for the purposes of propaganda. They're trying to impose their belief system on you. And I hope at least now you'll give them a second look and be a little bit critical about what they're representing. Okay, so back to the Cold War for next Tuesday, and we're going to look at the Corona spy satellite program. See you then.